Welcome to the ED Clinics podcast. My name is James Woolidge and I'll be your host for this series where we'll be discussing everything to do with shockwave therapy and men's health conditions. That's everything from erectile dysfunction through to chronic pelvic pain syndrome, Peyronie's disease, hard flaccid syndrome, amongst others. We'll be talking to a host of experts from around the world to shed some light on these complex conditions. And we'll also be talking to patients that have been through treatment journeys themselves so you can get a greater understanding of how we can help a broad range of people with these conditions. So without further ado, enjoy this episode.
Thanks for coming. Over the last, I think, probably couple of months, before Thomas got hold of me, I was like, this guy's everywhere. And so you had nearly like 250,000 on your YouTube channel, which I now tell patients about because I'm not just saying this because you're on my podcast, but they're like perfect little bite-sized bits that we tell patients about. Nitric oxide, that one that you did, the 8 sort of tactics for that. Yeah, that's really just exactly what patients are after. Yeah, I think that's really good. And then I sort of digging around. Usually I get patients to, I've been in clinical day, guests to talk about themselves, but I can't help but talk about him. Like, right, doctor, oh yeah, now I understand. So he's got PhD Scandinavian languages, consultant urologist, surgeon, sexologist, which we don't have for those in the UK listening. We have urologists specializing in sexual medicine or andrologists. And then you have sports medicine qualifications as well. So 2 PhD, sports med, speak several languages, a YouTube sensation. That makes you pretty unique, right?
Next month, I'm going up for the exam for nutritional medicine.
Right.
I'm kind of nervous.
Yeah, that's impressive. Right. I don't even want to go into the machinations of your mind, but clearly you're not one for sitting around and just resting at peace.
No, I mean, I'm just a regular guy. So if you're interested in stuff and you look around and you easily get interested in this and that, and suddenly a few decades later, you have accumulated a lot of stuff.
Yeah, it's making me feel pretty bad because I might be a bit older than you. I'm 50 and you've managed to produce all of those things by the... How old are you, do you mind me asking?
I'm so sorry. I'm 57.
Oh, you're looking pretty good. I'll give you that.
Thanks.
So you currently have private practice in the middle of Germany?
Yes.
All right. And is that just you or do you work with a team of others or that's your thing?
No, it's just me. I made the experience that I'm quite good at doing things on myself.
Right.
So I get lots of things done. And, you know, the best thing about working alone is that you can make all your decisions yourself. And you take credit for all the good things that you decided, but you also take the beating for all the bad things that came out of it.
Yeah,
I don't have to discuss any topics with anybody concerning my YouTube channel. So I just come up with a topic and then I just do it.
And I think I heard on another podcast that I listened to you on that you've done 110 videos just pretty much around the penis or men's health.
Yes, something like that. It's around the penis.
Wow.
And when I started, I never thought one could do so many videos, so many different videos about the penis. But it turns out it's a pretty interesting organ. And there are lots of nuances that you can explore in the penis. And I was most fascinated, I think, about the fibrous skeleton of the penis.
Right.
You know, many species, they have a bone inside.
Yeah.
And we don't. So the penis, in principle, feels soft, but it isn't because it's some of the miracles of nature. So when the penis fills with blood, it suddenly becomes rigid because of this fibrous skeleton that expands because of the pressure inside the penis. And I think this is a just fabulous structure. If you look at it with all these pillars and connected to the outer surface, it's very fascinating.
It makes some of the words that are used around the penis somewhat difficult because you still, as you will probably get, you still have patients thinking there's a bone in there because, of course, there is still a diagnosis of a fractured penis. And so when people hear fractured penis, they think, well, there must be a bone in there to fracture. And you go, well, actually, no, it's a fibrous skeleton that actually is the fracture, in effect, the collagenous stuff that does it, not a bone. It's definitely got some interesting anatomy, as I've discovered over the last 5 or 6 years looking into this now. I mean, you spend all of your life doing men's health. I mean, for us in the UK, I'm part of a group of clinics called edclinics.co.uk. So we're physiotherapists, osteopaths. There are some medics involved in that as well. And it probably makes up only maybe 10, 15% of our working day. The rest is still for me musculoskeletal, which is how I got into Shockwave over 10 years ago. And your journey's been slightly longer than that, about 15 years ago, maybe, that you
Yeah,
started to get into
something like that. So I started out as a regular urologist. You go to med school, and then we, in my time, we had something which was called AIP, which is Arzt im Praktikum. So after I was done with med school, I had 1 year and a half that I was kind of a doctor for German standards, but I wasn't fully licensed. They abandoned that, but back in the day they had it, where I looked around in all kinds of specialties. So I was in gynecology and cardiology, internal medicine. I think I also did some geriatrics stuff. And then I ended up in urology. And as every urologist, I had a surgical training, and it's basically cancer. When you work in a hospital, most of the stuff that you see is about cancer. So I always regarded myself being an oncologist in a way. But relatively early in my career, I thought, well, what we're doing is maybe not the best of things, because we're leaving aside the sexual aspects. And as you mentioned, I've also studied literature. And if you look around and look at the world, sex is one of the main promoters of actions for people. So whenever there's anything, you can be pretty sure sex is involved. And if you read novels, it's everywhere in the novels. So I was actually, when I was getting out of med school, I wasn't quite sure if I wanted to become a doctor. So I was interested in becoming a consultant. And I had a job interview at the Boston Consulting Group. That was over 20 years ago. Then they were asking us. So the first branch was in they opened in Boston, and then they re opened in Tokyo. And they were asking us, so why do you think it was Tokyo? And so everybody was speculating about the economy and it being so important. And I was so stupid, I didn't speak up, because I immediately thought, well, because there was some kind of woman in Tokyo, and that was the solution. So he had a girlfriend in Tokyo, so he opened a new branch in Tokyo. So there's sexual motives everywhere, and this is what I thought was so important. So we rip out the prostates, and for that matter, also the bladders, and then we say, here you go. You will live for many decades, but we don't care about your sex life, because it's your private life, and farewell. This is how we do it, and this is how we still do it today. And because of that, I got interested in sexual medicine, and I started to do all this stuff with PDE5 inhibitors. But then I came to a point where I thought, well, it can't be everything. So I was interested in becoming a sexologist, and this is the psychologic part of things. So I learned sex therapy at the Charité University Hospital in Berlin. That was a course that went over many years, I think 2 years. And then I studied, because you had to hand in all these cases. It wasn't just going into a course, you had to make your homework and have patients, see patients, get supervised, do therapies, get supervision on the therapies. Was quite complicated. And
Okay.
this is how it all started.
Yeah, right. I mean, that's a hell of a journey. You can't say that you lack commitment in this journey that you've
No,
been on, by the
no.
sound of it. And I mean, it goes without saying. I mean, this podcast is principally set up, it was originally set up about 5, 6 years ago for practitioners using Shockwave. But actually, as I've discovered, there are a lot of people that are now, particularly in men's health, there's some very well-educated patients that go on a big journey of understanding, and they often find the podcast and then come and see me or some of my colleagues as a consequence of that. So I'm always aware of that now, that I want as much from this podcast to be for patients necessarily as I would for practitioners. And on that note, I mean, probably most of this is going to be about ED, but I like your point, which you made on the other podcast, I think, about if you had a selection of patients with men's health in for the day, you would be really enthusiastic and happy about patients with CPPS, which for most people, they would have understand that being chronic prostatitis, which I also I sort of completely agreed with your point on that, which is it's become a little bit of a throwaway term for when you've got pain down there and you've got no evidence of infection, and then you get told you've got non-bacterial prostatitis, because they're the ones that with shockwaves are brilliant. We all agree this now in the working groups that I'm in. And then followed up with that would be a, reasonable chance that shockwave will help with your ED if you're good at picking the right patients. And then my experience a long way after that is the Peyronie's aspect, which is really difficult to treat. And I think that presents to me the biggest challenge on a number of levels, because you will know this, is that they are by far and away the most emotive group, partly because you so much sympathize for them. And they're the most motivated to try and get better, because the dysfunction can be enormous, the emotional toil it takes upon them. I think that unfortunately, there's one downside about shockwave. Most of it's brilliant, but lots of people have got shockwave devices now, or what they would call shockwave devices, radio otherwise. And I think lots of these patients, when we've been doing it 6 or so years now, and we're starting to see more and more patients see us from having seen other clinics where they've been promised quite a lot of good outcomes with Peyronie's and spent a lot of money, and then and not being really assessed properly and told realistic expectations. I mean, that's, I guess you're in the same boat with that, are you? Because you must see a lots of other people from that have tried to see lots of other urologists and then come to see you as a specialist. What can you give us your overview on those three, those sort of three?
I totally agree. And I think you have a big advantage over doctors because you are a physiotherapist. And we don't learn the stuff that you learn about muscle, about how the body works. And I think this is a bit disadvantage for doctors because we don't think in that terms, in these terms. There's one thing, this is kind of how I got into this. It's because of golf. You know, I play golf.
Oh, yeah.
And so I get all these injuries like everybody else. And then I got interested. So how do I cure that stuff? And then I entered into the Titleist Performance Institute, which is a big company in the US. And they teach people how to assess the golf swing. And they have three paths that you can move down. This is a medical, golf, and fitness. So I did the medical qualification, and there was a big chunk of physiotherapy and physiotherapeutic thinking about the body, how the body works in patterns, and when these patterns don't work well, because like it's a pattern of stable and mobile segments, and if you have a mobile segment that is stable because you have some problem, then you get a problem in the whole body. And so I think this is something that I think very much when I think about the pelvic floor. And we haven't learned to think about this. So I think you're much better at this than I am.
I think you, well, I don't know, but I mean, it's certainly one of those areas we're always thinking about. And I think I listened to one of your other podcasts where you said something interesting. It got me thinking about how just treating the pelvic floor in some instances can improve erectile function. And I've definitely seen patients that I was like, oh, that may be the reasoning behind that. The younger males in their 30s, you've seen a few post-COVID with erectile dysfunction, that and seemingly they're very healthy and fit. They're not really a great candidate for having a vascular erectile dysfunction, but and they get, pretty good nighttime erections, morning erections. That's unchanged. But when it comes to the actual performance itself, and they would pretty much say, yes, it has become a bit of an anxiety issue. So there's no doubt that bit between the ears. But I wonder, as part of that anxiety, it's driving pelvic hypertension, if you like, in those. And then when we treat that area, that's probably the bit that's out of the sort of protocol we use, which is treating the crura as well as the penile shaft. They often say within 2 or 3 sessions, I'm much better. And I think it's partly because they're getting help and their anxiety improves. I think that's part of it. But I think that there is probably, from what you say, there is probably some releasing of tension in the pelvic floor that is then helping them move forward.
This is especially when there are trigger points and when you hit these trigger points, and you have seen it as well, I'm sure. You barely touch them with shock waves and they scream because it's so painful. You have adapted. I'm very happy if I have some of those patients because I know they're going to be fine. If I can't just put in a lot of power and they don't say anything, then I'm kind of worried because I think maybe it's not working. But starting with your three diseases that we treat with shock waves, I totally agree. And I say if you're looking for a miracle, then treat somebody with pelvic pain, especially somebody who has been to other places. But problem is, I can't help everybody. So I would say maybe 5 or 6 out of 10 if you select them carefully. But I mean, this is better than none.
So can you just you give a really good summary of trying, as you've discovered on your journey, trying to select patients with Peyronie's, just to clarify from a sort of urological surgical point of view with your experience, because we try and teach this when we teach in this country that there are some candidates that might work and there are some candidates that won't work, pretty much won't work. Can you just give your summary of trying to pick those Peyronie's patients out and what those ones
Yes.
that you would take on?
Generally, after having cranked up my machines to the highest levels in Peyronie's disease, I can say it doesn't affect curvature. This is my conclusion in neither of them, neither with calcified or non-calcified plaques. That's for sure. So I think there is not one single modality to treat Peyronie's disease. So I am treating in a pattern where I combine several treatments for Peyronie's disease. And when I get a patient, I first determine whether it's in the acute phase or the stable phase. Mostly we'll get patients in the stable phase because they don't know what's going on. And then many valuable months are lost until they finally come to us and get an examination. Then I look at it with the ultrasound. And it's very important whether there are calcified plaques or non-calcified plaques. As soon as I see calcifications, things become very complicated because up to now, I'm not quite sure whether they can be helped with anything but surgery. So what you can try is maybe you can stop that. That's not getting this severe. Maybe you can have a curvature that's still functional. But to reduce curvature, I don't think it's possible in calcified plaques. I'm doing my approach mainly in non-calcified plaques.
And would you, sorry, just to clarify, would you treat them in the acute phase at all, or would you just not do any of the interventions in the acute phase?
In the acute phase, I would try to stop the inflammation. So
Right.
there are some at least theoretical reason to think that tadalafil could do that
Yeah.
because of its interaction with TGF beta 1, I think it is, so that this chronic inflammation that's going on can be stopped. Because, in theory, today you have a 30 degree angulation and it can go up to 90 or even 100 degrees. And we don't really want that. And I give them also L-arginine and citrulline just to have some antioxidants to stop this inflammation. I have the impression it works in most of them, not in all, but it works in most. This is what I would do with a calcified plaque. I think one could try traction in these. Traction is a big part of my approach because I don't think you can reduce curvature without traction. And traction also gives the advantage that, penile length is lost. And when you apply traction, you can regain some of the length that has been lost.
And do you use
How
what do you use a particular device? Do you use the Restorex?
I more, yes, I think this is my favorite right now.
For those who are listening, the Restorex is a traction device. That's as simple as that. It's one of many. So you almost, in a way, you're probably trying to take those patients and say, look, actually, this is probably not a good idea. And then you still get those patients to say, even though it's a 1% chance, I'm still willing to go for it.
So, no, if we talk about shockwaves, we haven't talked about shockwaves yet.
Gotcha.
So, what's happening in these with the non-calcified plaques is that they get really soft. Have you seen this too?
No, well, you palpate and you think you get a softer plaque, but the patients report that they feel less of a plaque, and there is good evidence, I think, now that there is plaque reduction with shockwave. It's just that
Yeah,
sometimes
but
it doesn't go into curve reduction, which is the annoying thing.
no. It's immediate softening of the plaque. So the non-calcified plaques, I can't really feel them anymore. So even during treatment, I get the impression, okay, now I have to really search. Where is it? Almost feels like it is gone. And this
Right.
is what the patients also say. So after 3 to 4 days, it gets hard again. So I have no explanation for this. But in theory, like if I would apply traction in during these days, having a flexible and soft plaque, this is my argument for doing shock waves, because I soften it up, and then I apply traction, and then I can reduce curvature. And I had effects with that. So it's possible to do that, but the chances are not very high, I have to say.
And
But I
what
have some patients where it worked.
would okay. And what do you generally do? Because there'll be people listening to this that are practitioners that want some takeaways, as they always do from this. I mean, is your general view that every Peyronie's you see is roughly a dozen treatments, or it's not two treatments, right? Is there a sort of general
No.
kind of number that you tend to suggest to patients that you're going to need to see me weekly for however many?
I have a tendency to say, okay, maybe between 10 to 15,
Right.
depending on the patient and how far he has to travel.
Yeah.
And we always have to think that if we're looking at research on Peyronie's disease and on results, this is not 1 or 2 weeks apart. We're talking about 6 months, 12 months. These are the time frames that we have to look at our results. It takes forever. And stretching, it's a lifestyle almost, because you have to stretch for up to 8 hours a day, which would be an advantage of the Restorix.
And do you have you I mean, there has been lots of debate about the energy usage we should use in Peyronie's disease. One, I think one of the recent ones was better results with a lower energy, and then there's people that say you need to go beyond. I think Professor Lund, I think, is now using I think the C-Actor, that which is an electromechanical device from Storz, which is beyond the 0.55 millijoules that my device goes to, and he thinks that would be better, but I don't think we have any evidence yet for any particular energy level. Nothing concrete.
No.
What's your instinct on Peyronie's and a normal plaque?
There has been debate on increasing the level of energy in Peyronie's plaques. I think my colleague Post in Hamburg, he's a promoter of this hypothesis, and he does a lot of this. I'm personally also using the C-Actor for Peyronie's disease, and I'm using it on the highest level, because maybe it's the urologic thinking about breaking stones with ESWL, that I think we can, the more power I get into this, the better it is. But if this is true or not, I'm not quite sure. I've the Storz Duolith right now. Before that, I had the Arias 2
Right.
from Dornier.
Oh yes. Yeah.
And on the Arias, I was shooting at much lower frequency, lower energy levels. And I think this is something that you have to consider as well. It's the machine that you're using, and the focus length and the focus size on each of those machines. So with the Arias, the focus point is quite n near the surface of the applicator, which makes it almost feel like a radio shockwave device. And if you increase the energy, it really hurts the patient. And I've also seen at the higher energy levels some bruising of the skin. You have to constantly move it around, otherwise the skin gets bruised,
Right.
which is not the case in the C-Actor handpiece. I can like double the energy that I used at the Arias device, and still the patient doesn't feel anything. And even if you have your finger, I'm using a gauze swab on the other side, and I really had to use it with the Arias, because it would really hurt my finger through the
Right.
penis.
Yeah.
But this is not happening in the same way in the Storz device. So I don't really have to use a gauze swab for the sepia handpiece.
Right. And
And
that level goes up to what? Is that the 0.55, or have you got the one that goes to
yes.
1.24? Just 0.55.
Yes. Yeah.
So if we just on the moving on to the ED front, which is where most of our patients sit. I mean, you would see patients between the ages of approximately 40 and 70, I think I heard you say, which is roughly us as well, seeing that group. Do you have a particular, where you rub your hands together and say, this is the right patient for me? Is it, over here, we sort of, when we see patients, if they're responding to PDE5s already, they're getting morning erections, they're relatively healthy. Of course, they're good patients, and you're welcoming them into clinic. Have you got any other insights in your experience as to what patient selection looks like for you with an ED?
I roughly say between 40 and 65. These are the ages where I can be pretty sure if it has worked before 40, then the psychogenic component is not that prevalent. So I will mostly get people with malfunctions of the body because of the age, the aging process, something like that. And if it's 70, 75, I think there's lots of aging that has been going on, and it's very hard to revert that process in people that old. But I usually do, I palpate the penis. There's
This
something.
wheat bread thing I heard you just
Yes.
Well, yeah,
Like
explain what that was. I got lost in translation with that.
if you buy a fresh loaf of bread,
Yeah.
and it's mostly the bread that you buy in America, or I think also in the UK, wheat bread, and it's very fresh, and you can squeeze the loaf like this, and it
Right.
gets this thin.
Yeah.
This is what I call the wheat bread penis, because if there's lots of tissue lost, then you can easily squeeze this like a fresh loaf of bread. And there's no resistance. It's very fluffy. This is what I call the wheat bread penis. And I've bad experience with that.
So that's age-related penile atrophy in effect. And
Yeah.
yeah, I mean it makes sense. What are you rejuvenating? If the tissue's not there to rejuvenate, then it's not great. I'm just interested to know how you do you warm the patient up for that. I'm just gonna give your penis a squeeze just to see how it feels.
I don't think he notices it, because I always palpate the penis for Peyronie's plaques,
Right.
because this is one of the differentials in ED. This
Yeah.
is why I do ultrasound on all penises. Once in a while, I see Peyronie's plaques, and then I know, okay, this is an ED because of that, and they don't have any deviation of any kind, and they didn't even know they had Peyronie's disease.
And
But
do
that would be the diagnosis.
I scan as well. Do you do the whole thing in short axis? Do you come all the way up, or do you do a long axis view as well? Just short
Both.
axis, both.
Both.
The short axis is really easy to see, isn't it? It's just a quick scan through and you can see that. Yeah. It's a bit of a difficult one when you see those patients. And I personally don't treat those. I've sent a few back to their surgeons, and that's not obviously what they want to hear, having their penis sliced open. So I mean, moving on, we the ED concept point of view, as you're a sexologist, I mean, do you have, because we get this sometimes when we're teaching, how much do you place importance upon the lifestyle aspect when you're seeing these patients? Do you sort of say to the patients, look, it's unless you do this, this, and this, the shockwave is not going to work that well? Or do you just hand them information to give and assume they're doing it? I mean, how much of a hard line do you take with your patients? There are some practitioners I know that say, well, if you don't lose the weight and get rid of the diabetes, this is a waste of time, whatever else.
No, I'm not that tough.
Right.
What I really insist on is smoking.
Oh, okay.
This is so bad for your health and for everything.
Yeah.
And I tell them, it says, even on the package, it says it makes you impotent. And people don't believe it. But I think smoking is a big thing that one, if there is a problem with erectile function and you smoke, I think you have to quit smoking. This is more or less the only thing that I say. You have to meet people at the spot they are in, so to speak, and work around. And I'm always asking about lifestyle, because we know from research that if you are active, and even if you are obese or overweight and you are active, you have a better chance that, for example, PDE5 inhibitors will work. So I always promote some kind of regular physical exercise. And if they haven't done it, I tell them, okay, pick a walk of your choice and pick a pace of your choice and just do it every evening. And maybe after 2 months, you will see suddenly you arrive 10 minutes earlier for some reason that you don't know, because you're walking faster without knowing it. And then you do a bigger round. This is how you start. Just do little changes. Don't change anything at all of it at all in the beginning.
And do you have, just ask about Cialis or tadalafil, do you prescribe that quite often for Peyronie's and for ED, I assume? Do you go for a low dose, 5, 2.5 milligram per day daily dose, or do you go for a
Yes.
bigger dose with that?
Depends on where I start. If it's just for checking whether it is working, which is the start of every kind of therapy that I apply. Then I go for the maximum dose, which is 20 milligrams. I think it's easier on a psychological level because if this is working, you can easily say, okay, now it's working, just reduce it.
Yeah.
But if it's not working and they get the hot flushes and the stuffed nose, then tell them you double the dose now. They wouldn't do it.
That seems so obvious now you say it. Yeah. Good point. I think that my view on all these podcasts, unfortunately, is I try to keep them as short as possible. What's clear to me is that we're going to have you back on for other topics, including one more specific perhaps for patients, because your educational stuff is great. I think that from our perspective, in terms of users in this country, it's great having someone like you on, because I think you might be the, I've had consultant orthopedic surgeons on talking about MSK stuff, but having a urologist with insight and with the confidence that you have in shockwave therapy, I think it gives us confidence that we're not entirely losing our minds, and we're doing a good thing by trying to achieve change with shockwave. And just that point, I mean, just to clarify, for I still get these questions come up, which is radial shockwave has got its place in superficial myofascial trigger point work. Still get questions about true shockwave. And I'm like you with this. I think there is just shockwave and there is radial pressure wave, and they're very distinctly different things. But you just use shockwaves and focused shockwaves for people that still think that for men's health conditions, right?
But I mean, yes, because the evidence that we have and the way shockwaves work, as opposed to radial pressure waves, there is a difference. And generally, I believe in shockwaves more than in radial pressure waves when it comes to men's health. But I'm a curious guy. I'm always open to new approaches because, you know, the things change and what is hip today is out tomorrow, and you never know where
Yeah, sure.
things are moving. If radial pressure wave is on the surface, there is not much surface on the penis, so the penis is quite small. So, I mean, in theory, why wouldn't it work? Or would it work, for example, would it work better, the true shock wave with combined with a radial pressure wave? I don't know. Nobody knows, but
Yeah.
these are interesting questions.
So I'm going to put after this, I'm going to think that's, God, there's got another 15 questions I should have asked you, but I'm going to email you and organize a follow-up to this. But I will put a link on after this to your Euro channel on YouTube, which I think is fantastic. I'll also
Thank
put
you.
the other thing that I was interested in, which I might even be going on myself, is that you now do some specific men's health shockwave training with a colleague, don't you? I think in Germany. Is that you
No,
on?
in Canada.
Canada, that's right. Are they online, or are they all online? So I'll put a link to that after this as well with the Euro channel, people that might want to take
Yes, great.
on some of that training, because I think that you're just in the right space and place to do that.
So in this course, I did it this summer, during my summer vacation. So
And
I
what's
was
the website?
filming.
Is that I Love Shockwave? Is that right?
Yes,
I
I love
Love
shockwaves.
Shockwave. ILoveShockwaves.com. Right.
And this everything I know about shockwaves and how I treat my treatment protocols, how I place my patients, how I hold the plaque when I do Peyronie's disease,
Perfect.
and
That is
so.
that's been a real missing link, actually, because lots of people treat, and this is to some extent there is I could really waffle on about this, some protectionism about how we all do our things, and no one really wants to share that much. So it's great that you're doing. So I'm gonna wrap this up, and thank you very much for coming on the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
We're gonna have you back. You don't know it yet, but I'm gonna do that. But thank you very much for your time, Stefan. Have a lovely evening. I'll see you later.
Thanks.
Bye bye.
Bye bye.